Hey, podcast listeners, this is Michael Shelley, and hope you're having a good summer, good end of summer. I am about to go on a three-week vacation, so you'll have listeners to the radio show. We'll have the great Todd Ophonic Todd filling in for me all 3 weeks, and he'll be interviewing Ace Frehley, so that should be interesting to say the least. So you might want to tune in for that on Saturday morning. Today I've got, I was supposed to have P.F. Sloan and Marty Stewart. P.F. Sloan, he wasn't there when we called, but we're trying to reschedule that, and I think it will happen eventually. So we just got Marty Stewart today. Very interesting guy, good records, great band, on tour now. I'll leave it at that. I'll see you in a few weeks. Here is my interview with Marty Stewart. 99 and a half just won't do. Well, I want to go a little further. Let my sisters and my brothers try to make the grave. See some lost souls saved. I'm a moving, I'm a grooving. Are you moving? Are you grooving? Let me tell you, 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99 and a half just won't do. There he is, the great Marty Stewart. He is a multiple Grammy winner, a platinum recording artist, a Grand Ole Opry member and star, a collector of cool country music stuff. I think he has at least 16 top 40 country music chart singles. He's got a new album coming, I think, September 30th, called Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. And he's playing with the fabulous Superlatives, his band, at Joe's Pub. Two shows Friday, August 15th. Two shows. And he's just starting a tour, and I'm happy he joins us this morning. Marty Stewart, welcome to WFM. You and good morning.
Good morning, sir. Glad to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Now, I believe you're in Potosi, Missouri, or on your way there. You've got the Washington County Fair tonight.
I have my first cup of coffee in my hand. We raised the blinds on the bus. I'm looking at cousin Kenny Vaughn and the Tilt-A-Whirl.
Ah, Kenny Vaughn is, wow, that sounds like fun. Now
that's glamour, pal. It's glamour.
Yeah, take a ride before the show, maybe.
That's right.
Your story is really quite interesting. You know, you got to Nashville, I think, and you were age 13, and there's in one of the liner notes of your CDs, you step off the bus, and it's kind of, in your head, it's been this magic place. And when you get off the bus in the early 70s, 72, I think, it's a dump. You know, there's it says the seedy part of town, and it's very interesting how you've ridden the waves of Nashville up and down through the years.
Well, when I look at Nashville now, if you go and take a look at the skyline at 2 o'clock in the morning these days, it's quite impressive if you'd seen it back in that day you're talking about, because it had really kind of run out of gas. It was on the tail end of the Civil War era, and it really had turned into peep shows and, you know, just kind of the lowest of the low downtown. And the Greyhound bus station was right in the middle of town at that time, and so I rode the Greyhound bus from Mississippi up to meet my friend Roland White, who was going to pick me up. And when I got off the bus, you know, he wasn't there. He had actually gone to a jam session and lost track of time. So here I am with my suitcase and my mandolin in my hand, standing there. And it was scary. I think that even today I'd probably be scared. It had an edge to it, I can tell you that.
Yeah, you were a teenage kid, really, and through your friend, you got into basically Lester Flatt's band. When you were how old when you started playing with Lester?
13. I had been out on the circuit for about a year. I was traveling with a group of people called the Sullivan Family Gospel Singers from down in Alabama, who were Southern Church House Pentecostal bluegrass stars. They were wonderful people, and the Bluegrass Festival circuit was kind of a part of their thing, too, sometimes. And so I had run into Roland White, who worked with Lester, and he had gives me a casual invitation. If you ever get to or want to come to Nashville, call me. You can ride along on the bus that weekend. So that's all that came together.
And you stayed on the bus until Lester Flatt passed away, basically, in 1979. Where did the music come from? I mean, did you teach yourself? Did your parents? Because you're known really as a multi-instrumentalist, and you play everything great. And
That may be a little overstated. I really only play the guitar and the mandolin. There was a very musical house. My mother and daddy, they loved music. My grandpa Stewart was an old-time Mississippi string band fiddle player. Never made a living at it, of course. He was a farmer, but he did it for the joy of it. And my mother played just a little church house piano, but music was always, the radio was always on. Good records were always being played. it was very definitive, and it shows up in this new project because my mother really loved gospel music. She liked country music. She liked Connie Smith and some people like that, but she loved gospel music. So she loved, you know, I was well-versed on Southern gospel music, and my daddy loved country music and that string band music, bluegrass music. So it was pretty well-rounded house.
Yeah, I read, I think, in something you wrote about the local radio station that played at certain part of the day top 40, another part of the day soul music, another part of the day gospel, and then easy listening to kind of end the day, and that you grew up thinking all radio stations were like that, and it's a kind of a beautiful picture in the mind.
So true. You know, it only takes one visionary, and that visionary in Philadelphia, Mississippi, was a fellow named Mr. Howard Cole, and the radio station was 1490 WHOC, 500 watts, and in the morning it signed on with country music, then they played country music till the noon hour, and then they had gospel music for an hour, and then top 40 and rock and roll in the afternoon, easy listen. And I truly did. I thought everybody's radio station was filled with that kind of music.
If somebody had started a band, you know, and wanted somebody to play like Steve Cropper, was there any chance that you were going to go in another direction, or was it always going to be country for you?
Country music touched my heart the deepest. I heard all kinds of music coming from that part of the world. But it was truly country music that touched my heart the deepest, and I think I always wanted to play country music.
So you're on the road with Lester Flatt. You're just a teenager, and you know, it's the late 70s, and there's the kind of outlaw movement happening, and some country is starting to change, but I assume Lester still had his foot in sort of the old camp, and you're kind of straddling both worlds. That must have been interesting.
Well, the thing that was so interesting about Lester, I knew from the minute that I went to work, the first two records I ever had was Lester Flatt and Johnny Cash, so I was totally head over heels in love with Lester's music, Flatt and Scruggs' music, the day I started. But the thing that I loved the most is when I got out and got into Nashville, and Lester actually started playing the college campus kids early on. And so all of a sudden we became rock stars and got to be a part of that.
Kind of the new, younger audience accepted you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about after Lester, you joined Johnny Cash's band for the next 5 years or so. Again, just a crazy wave to get onto.
Well, Lester passed away, and there I was, you know, because I never even had to think about getting a job from the time I, you know, arrived in town. And so Lester passed away, and I played a few minutes with Vassar Clements, and we used to play the Lone Star. Remember the old Lone Star in New York City?
Sure.
And that was a wonderful place to play with him. That was kind of his home base. And then Doc and Merle Watson for just a few months. Then the job with Johnny Cash came through. And it was absolutely, you know, a cyclone ride. It was wonderful.
I mean, Johnny Cash, a complex guy, you know, kind of, you know, hard time with drugs sometimes, or hard time making, you know, focusing on music. But clearly the music was pretty deep in this guy. Was he volatile to be around?
Well, not from my perspective. I mean, I saw his frailties. We all had our frailties back in the day. But the thing that was absolutely paramount with him was great songs. The thing that you could do what you found. I mean, it didn't take 2 seconds into his presence. You knew that you were in the presence, not of just a great personality, but of a great artist. His musical tributaries ran deep, deep, deep. And from the day that I went to work with him, that's the thing that I saw. He was a man about the song, and he was fearlessly creative. And if he believed in something, he would go to any ends of the earth to carry it out, whether anybody came to see it or listened to it or not. But I learned so much from him. About creativity.
It took you, I mean, you stopped playing with Johnny Cash, I think, around 85, and then it takes you a few years to figure out what your thing is going to be, and I think your breakthrough was probably Hillbilly Rock in 1990, and from then, for the next 10 years, you're your road is straight up. You become sort of a country superstar, and I think as you describe, playing, you know, loud music with bright lights, and at the end of the 90s, you kind of reevaluate what, you know, how you got to where you were, and if you're happy there. What happened at that moment when you had to kind of reinvent yourself, or when you chose to?
Well, we had become, let me rephrase it. I had become a band that was neither fish nor fowl. It was loud. It was butt wiggling. It was, we were filling up rooms of all sizes. There seemed to be no end to it, but it was really, it felt like a hollow victory to me because it did not pay off to me in my heart the way that traditional country music had, you know, as a kid, or what I'd listen to when I'd go at the end of the night. I would still put on Merle Haggard or John or Bill Monroe. I would still put on that kind of music. And the music I was making did not affect me in the same manner that the music those people were making. And I knew that I was posing a little bit just to keep up with the times and be a part of the popularity parade. So the roots had kind of disappeared. I think the roots had faded. They were there, but they were covered up and they were faded. So it seemed to me that it was time to go back to the roots and start over and start fresh and rebuild. And that is what happened from the day the Fabulous Superlatives were formed to this minute. And I could not be happier.
Yeah, the Fabulous Superlatives are your band, and they do seem to be a big part of what you're about these days. It, you know, I've always found it interesting that that almost every country artist, the biggest ones who you hear interviewed, they always pay lip service to guys like Hank Williams, but their records don't sound anything like Hank Williams. And it's that there's a weird dichotomy between what they say and what the music sounds like.
Well, and that's why it's important to think. I was watching this past week some old film of Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and the Foggy Mountain Boys. And one of the comments that I made, what they played on the record when you went to see them in person, they played the same. You got to hear the record in person, verbatim. Kind of like going to see Duke Ellington. You would hear what made you fall in love with Duke Ellington. They stayed true to the arrangement. And Flatt and Scruggs, you know, they were original. And I hear a lot of people, you know, so what, do what you just said. They talk, they pay lip service, but it's another thing to live through it and be a part of it and you know, create that kind of originality for yourself. And so that's the mission at hand here in this band.
Yeah, the country music world is really an interesting world for so many reasons, just for its place in American culture and to watch what it's changed, you know, from the 40s through now. It's just the history of America is kind of in the history of country music. I want to remind everybody, Marty Stewart is our guest, and he's got a gig at Joe's Pub in Manhattan Friday. It's Friday the 15th, and there's two shows, 7:30 and 9:30, and you're in the middle of a tour tonight in Potosi, Missouri, at the Washington County Fair, and then Philadelphia, New York, Virginia, North Carolina, South Dakota, Iowa, Illinois, all through October and November. You're touring because you've got this new record out called Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. And I assume it's still fun. I mean, it looks like you and your band have a great time. I mean, this band is everybody sings, everybody plays, everybody seems real musical in that band.
Oh, it is. I mean, I've been in band since I was 9 years old. And again, from the first moments of the rehearsal, of the initial rehearsal, the original get-together, the Fabulous Superlatives. I knew this was something special. I knew this was beyond chasing little hits up and down Music Row. I knew this was a band that was, it was about the culture. It was about the roots. It was about the musical missionaries or mercenaries, depending on how you look at it. But I knew this was big, and it was the band of a lifetime. I love going to work with Kenny Vaughan and Harry Stinson and Paul Martin every single night. Can't wait to get back on the bus and go to work.
It sounds like fun. For folks who have never seen you guys, especially folks up in this area, your TV show is on RFD-TV, the Marty Stewart Show, Saturdays at 8 p.m., and it is wonderful because it is really relaxed and, you know, it really puts you in the mind of those older, you know, like the Porter Wagoner had a show, and it was, you know, sort of like that, and people just come on and play with you guys, and you guys playing, there's some fun, and it's just terrific. And you really can get, and I think on YouTube there's lots of clips of you and this band, the fabulous Superlatives, playing, and it really sounds like fun. And you guys are, like I said, going to be at Joe's Pub August 15th. If folks don't have any country records at all, who should they go out and buy? What's your recommendation? What's a starting point for somebody who wants to like country music but doesn't know where to go?
Probably Johnny Cash Live at Folsom Prison would be the first person I would direct him to. That record has it all. It has a great personality. It is filled with great songs. There's energy in it. It's a little bit on the edge, and it'll stir your heart. And that's probably the first record I would invite anybody to go and listen to.
Yeah, that was one of the, 10 records my parents had that they just listened to over and over and over and over again. It's certainly a great record. Yeah. Now, you're also a guy who's managed to collect a lot of cool country stuff. You're almost like a unofficial archivist for country music. You've just got some amazing. I mean, people seem to just hand you guitars after you're done playing with folks. It seems like you have some rare snake charm ability. Listener Jay in Queens wants to know, how'd you get Clarence White's Telecaster?
Well, Clarence's brother Roland was the fellow we talked about earlier in this conversation who got me my job with Lester.
Mm.
And so when I first came to town, I lived at Roland White's home with him and his family until my family could move up from Mississippi. Maybe a year and a half, 2 years later, whatever it was. And so the White family became, like family to them. Roland, we played at the Grand Ole Opry last night, and Roland came by our dressing room to visit and say hello. So Clarence's wife, Susie, and their children, Bradley and Michelle, were just a part of that, family. After Clarence was killed in 1973, Susie moved back to Kentucky, where she was originally from California. And she brought all, the family belongings with her. And somewhere along the way, I got a call from Susie one night. She said, I need to sell some things. Would you be interested in coming and talking? This is early 1980. I just went to work with Johnny Cash. And so I said, absolutely. So I drove up to Kentucky where Susie lived, and that guitar was one of the things she had decided to sell.
Crazy. How many guitars have you got?
I don't know, and that's a true answer. Too many, I can tell you that.
Yeah, too many. That's a perfectly acceptable answer.
I'm still trying to learn to play one.
You're a fabulous guitar player, says me. MartyStewart.net is the website for information about everything pertaining to Marty Stewart and the band, and to see if they're coming to your town. I've got a song here queued up. It's from the brand new record. It comes out September 30th, Saturday night and Sunday morning. There's two discs. One is gospel and one is more traditional upbeat country music. And it's funny, you talk about in one of the press release maybe or the liner notes about this a great dichotomy in country music, which I've always enjoyed, where you go see a country band and they sing songs about drinking and partying or whatever it is, and then they stop the show and they always sing one sacred song. And I love that music. And it's a great moment. And some people do it real well, and some people do it a little more hammy or a little more religious, and some people make you just feel good with it. And it's a great, so I think, is that kind of the idea of this CD?
Well, that's part of it, and it's a part of the tradition that you can set your chips on that as being a solid fact. But one of the things about the Superlatives is the way we got to know each other, musically, professionally, spiritually, was by way of gospel music. When we first put the band together, we all brought our favorite gospel songs, around the band hall to listen to. I heard you playing 99 and a half won't do, before we started talking. That's a song we learned off of Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Kenny Vaughan brought Sister Rosetta's music in for us to listen to. Harry Stinson loved black gospel music. He brought the Swan Silvertones, the Dixie Hummingbirds. We listened to them. I brought the Staple Singers and Flatten Scruggs and some of that old bluegrass gospel stuff. Paul Martin, when he came to work with us, he came from Oak Ridge Boy World, so he brought a world of gospel music. So gospel music is simply how we learned to sing again. And then we started writing our own gospel songs. And when the TV show came along, to keep with that tradition you talked about, we always needed a gospel song. So first thing I know, we have this incredible pile of, 150, 200 gospel songs that we ought to be singing and doing something with. So it seemed like the thing to do. It's an honest reflection of who the band is. It's really not a poser kind of thing. It's we can stand there and back it up for an hour and a half if we need to. So
It's interesting. Yeah, sometimes I hear those gospel quartet records, and it blows your mind that four guys can stand around a microphone with no instruments and make that sound. You know, those are some real moving records.
Well, if I come from Mississippi, and so if you go down to Mississippi tomorrow morning, Sunday morning, and go to Robinsonville, Mississippi, to this little church, Pastor Evelyn Hubbard, who sings on a song on this record called Cathedral, her church house, you're going to have a hard time showing me the difference musically and what happens at Paul Tunkin's church. It's all rock and roll now, and it feels great. That's the word you talk about. It makes you feel good. It inspires you to go on, you know?
Yeah. Once again, Marty Stewart is playing at Joe's Pub here in New York August 15th. Two shows. That's Friday, August 15th, 7:30 and 9:30. And information over at MartyStewart.net. I've got the song Jailhouse queued up here, and that's from your forthcoming record. Tell us about this song.
Well, man loves woman.
Okay.
Woman don't love man, or she says she does, then get married. And from the minute she says I do, then she decides she don't. And so ice forms, and man winds up in a jailhouse of sorts. And so it was just, I wrote the song in like 5 minutes, I pulled over on the side of the interstate in Nashville on I-65, and I brought it to the band, and Kenny Vaughn, the first thing he did was, that's it. And so here we go.
Boom, and away we go. All right, let's hear it. We'll see you on Friday the 15th at Joe's Pub. It's been a real pleasure. You are one of the brightest lights in country music.
Well, thank you, my friend. Nice to talk to you, and I'll see you at Joe's Pub.
All right, we'll see you down the road.
Adios.
I'm living in a jailhouse, a jailhouse, a jailhouse is true. A jailhouse, a jailhouse, serving time with you. Deep dark dungeon with a gray stone walls, that's how it feels to me. A jailhouse, a jailhouse, she threw away the key. Well, I'd rather be busting rocks in that federal pen than to be locked up with your cold, low down heart. What a shame. Set me free when you feel the way I do. Cause I'm living in a jailhouse. Jailhouse, jailhouse is true. A jailhouse, serving time with you. Deep dark dungeon with the gray stone walls, that's how it feels to me. A jailhouse, she threw away. It's about time for me to make that big escape. Get the judge and jury to cut me loose. Take a hard look at my